Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and here at Bruegel, we are undergoing a research project on the future of work and inclusive growth in Europe. The project analyzes the impact of technology on the nature, quantity, and quality of work, welfare systems, and inclusive growth at large. The Sound of Economics is proud to contribute to the project with a space for discussion and analysis on this theme. And I'm happy to be accompanied today by Mario Mariniello, who is the Senior Fellow at Bruegel coordinating this project. Hi, Mario. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thank you, Giuseppe, for hosting.
In this episode, we will look into the impact of artificial intelligence on education with Teemu Ross, who is an expert and educator in AI, machine learning, and data science. His Three Elements of Artificial Intelligence online course for non-experts is rated as the world's best computer science MOOC on Class Central. So that's pretty impressive. Welcome to the Sound of Economics, Teemu. And if I'm not wrong, you are connected from Helsinki, right?
That is right. Hello, Giuseppe. Hi, Mario. It's my pleasure to be here joining you today.
Teemu, you are doing an incredible work in Finland to get citizens closer to AI, and I would like to know more about it. How did you get into all this, and what exactly the Three Elements of AI course is aimed at?
Well, that's a big question, of course. To start with, I'm not an educator by training. I'm just a computer scientist, so I'm a professor of computer science at the University of Helsinki. And the backdrop of where we started the project is the kind of frustration that we acknowledge that AI and digitalization are changing our lives, our societies, in so many ways. But still everybody seems to be talking and, trying to figure out what AI is about. There were so many misunderstandings and misconceptions. And the discussion wasn't really a constructive discussion trying to get to the bottom of things. It was more like piling like hype on top of hype and getting further and further, from my standpoint, from the actual things that we should be discussing. Just the basic things of what you can do with AI and what you can't do, what is realistic to expect, and so on. And these were getting in the way of so many conversations on, let's say, from business opportunities being missed or a lot of money being poured into kind of completely hopeless projects to also like societal discussions getting off the track. I could say that even at the university where I'm teaching data scientists, the students that came to take my classes, we had to sort of spend a few classes unlearning the false impressions and false expectations of what AI is about. We thought that, okay, well, since this is such a broad societal topic, it's really multifaceted. It's not a technological problem. It's a societal, it's even a political problem. And then we figured that, okay, we need to have more people on board, more people digesting and decomposing and deconstructing the idea of AI and its impact in the society. And therefore, we thought that, okay, well, we have our point of view, we have our idea of what AI is, what you can do with it, what you can't do with it, and we'll just share that to everyone. And that's what the Elements of AI aims at, just giving our point of view into the basic ideas and helping people then take part in the discussion. It's kind of opening the gates, opening the door for everyone to be joining the rational conversation, the fact-based conversation about AI.
Mario, do you want to?
Yeah, no, I mean, I sympathize very much with what you just said, Teemu. Thank you. For example, the whole discussion on automation, I think it's somehow distracting, if you want. We are talking so much about robots that will steal the jobs, and we don't talk so much about the impact on the quality of jobs. Well, what indeed it means to endorse the artificial intelligence paradigm on our daily life. So the societal impact is very important. I'm curious to know whether you think this is just by chance that we have been captured by this narrative, or is it like more a deliberate attempt somehow by, I don't want to
conspiracy, right?
This big distraction, that let's put it this way, this big distraction does somehow help those who are kind of controlling a little bit how technology is being developed and somehow getting most of the benefits from it. You know, in the US, there is an ongoing discussion, for example, about the role of universities and, you know, how industry may have been able to capture a little bit the narrative. So I wonder whether you thought about it, whether you think that this is not really by chance, that we have to unlearn, that you have to teach your students to unlearn what they think.
Yeah, no, that's a fascinating question. You know, this like, can it be a coincidence? Of course, it sounds a little bit like, you know, conspiracy, like one plus one, can it be a coincidence? But to be honest, I think it's yes and no. I think there's unfortunate turns of events that have gotten us into a place where there's false expectations, there's a lot of hype, and of course this tends to happen in all technology. You know, you've got the Gartner hype cycle, and I've been just recently thinking like how well that does or doesn't captured the dynamics in AI, where we've already actually had two so-called AI winters over the course of history in the 60s and the 80s or thereabouts. So I think this seems to be something that tends to happen like almost unavoidably, that you get false expectations and people sort of benefit from spinning things a little bit too much to their best interest. And then as it comes to AI, I'm sure there is also sort of a truth to what you're saying, that some of the big corporations, perhaps some, you know, some governmental actors, I guess it's no secret that China is sort of doing its best to steer the narrative to a certain direction, where for instance, the role of Europe is downplayed intentionally, because it seems that, the kind of US-China battle, arms race, and so on. These kind of narratives, they seem to be coming sort of intentionally from certain people and certain institutions. So yeah, I don't know, like if I can answer, like it's a yes or no. Like it's also sort of something that tends to happen no matter what, but it's also so that in some ways this discussion has been intentionally muddled. And for instance, one of the things that I'm kind of concerned about in concrete terms is the kind of lobbying that goes around trying to hamper the ability of the European Union to be an effective regulator of AI and the big corporations. Obviously, they're lobbying huge amounts of money spending in that, and trying to stop the EU's AI Act, which is now in the working process. So, just like very rambling discussion. I see what you're saying, and there is some truth to that.
But would like to go back to the discussion around the skills and the work that you've been doing with the online course, because as you say, there's a lot of false expectations, or there are a lot of assumption about what AI can do and what AI cannot do. Some of them, they are very much in the realm of science fiction. You know, you have some, from one side, you have the techno-utopist kind of narrative, and the other narrative is like the techno-dystopian kind of narrative. We don't want to focus on this in our conversation, but definitely this is part of what we were discussing, you know, like the kind of assumptions. But then concretely in the work that you are doing with the course, which are concretely the kind of skills that you are trying to project to the people, which are the kind of things that also as normal citizens we should be aware of and learn about AI, in your opinion?
Well, now that you mentioned this, like utopian, dystopian, this kind of extreme, very bold, kind of speculative point of view to AI, that's exactly the type of things that we'd like to get away from. And somebody had this slogan, make AI boring again. And I very much like to make AI boring again, in the sense that, not in the sense to sort of say that, okay, there's nothing to see, you know, you can go home now, but rather to say that people already, they can kind of start from what they know. like whoever, like whatever their profession is, whatever their hobbies or interests are, they can start from that. And they can then start sort of moving towards more, you know, elaborate ways to automate things or to add a little bit of AI methods to that. Then it doesn't look so alien. It's not that AI is something sort of completely distinct from their sphere of life. We're using AI systems every day. Our smartphones are full of them. Every single application somehow uses AI these days. And everybody's work, let's say be that a teacher, an artist, you know, a bus driver, a plumber, a politician, has some elements where AI could be used. And our goal is to help people see that, exactly as I said, like see that AI is not something completely distinct from what they know already and what they're doing for a living. It's something that can be applied to that. And it's not rocket science or alchemy or snake oil or some sort of, you know, fancy pants stuff. It's kind of boring in the sense that it's already familiar to them. And, you know, as a teacher, they could probably think much better than I what components in their work have this typical telltale signs of something that can be automated, namely being repetitive or routine-like and sort of being potentially a source of lots of data. And if you have that, if you have a process that you're repeating in your work and you could sort of accumulate data from it, then probably that's a good starting point for some, at least analytics. And then from analytics, it's a really small step, or it's like a, you know, it's a fuzzy border between analytics and AI. And then people can get started from there. So we'd like to sort of show them that is AI is not something really strange and exotic. It's something that is sort of almost familiar to them already. They don't have to change their way of thinking and doing their work completely upside down if they're going to go into AI. And that's sort of, yeah, that's the main idea that we'd like to give to people.
And how it has been the reaction to this, you know, like practically, do you have some examples of people that have been learning certain skills in their workplace, for instance, and things that can be applied and that they change their behavior by benefit of your class?
Definitely, there's been some of them. I don't remember if it was from the elements of AI or some other training programs that we've been offering. But nonetheless, there's been people let's say working in the fashion industry and then sort of coming up with an idea of a platform where people could share their designs and, you know, the patterns that they've created for like sewing clothes and doing new like fashion innovations. And then sort of doing that crowdsourcing support for that. That's an example. And then there was another example doing something to do with arts. Like, again, like I think that was also to do with fabrics. And these are things like I could never come up with ideas to do with fabrics or fashion because I'm not like, I don't know anything about how that works and how people actually come up with new designs. So I think those are some of the ideas. And of course, I've heard some people sort of like maybe taking a little bit of a turn in their career trajectory and starting to study data science after getting excited about it. And hopefully, again, there I see they'd be able to combine their expertise from their, like, let's say, past professional life and data science. I think that's where the big ideas come from. Like knowing two different fields or two different professions and being able to sort of combine them and merge them somehow.
Mario.
Oh, thank you. I'm actually curious to know a little bit more on the demand side, no? So how much people are interested in this and how do you attract them to, you know, to start even the learning process? This is actually a very important question because I mean, if you look at the figures, according to OECD, those who have a level of education which is below or equal to secondary school have 1/3 probability to join upskilling programs compared to those who have a high education background, and this has something to do also with the, you know, with the relationship with the educational system and so on and so forth. So really the problem is really how do we get people to get into these training programs, and so I wonder whether you can, with your experience, we can maybe generalize and find some lessons to that would help to address this problem at the at more general level, maybe a European level.
Ah, yeah, that's a brilliant question. I was going to say that there's no shortage of demand for interest towards AI. I think AI as a topic, it is so prominently debated and highlighted in the media and everywhere that it kind of sells, so to speak, itself. You know, there's been 775,000 people signed up on the course by now. But then also what you're saying is that, unfortunately, we haven't kind of, we haven't a silver bullet to the problem that you mentioned, that according to our study, a majority of the people who are taking the course already have some university studies behind them. So, you know, we have this bias, unfortunately. We can't reach everyone to the to an equivalent degree. And in that sense, even though, of course, when we started off, we were thinking of, you know, the digital skills gap, that some people are kind of behind in their digital skills. And we were thinking of bridging that gap by an openly accessible, free, and, you know, easy to approach course. But in a certain way, it seems that we're making the thing worse, because it seems that people who have done MOOCs before, who have done some university studies or at least high school studies, and who have degrees already, and they're like professionals, they're doing it more than those who haven't, or those who aren't. So in that sense, that is still a problem. Even with us, we haven't sort of cracked the code on that side. But we've made some progress, though. Like if you look at the statistics of how many MOOC users, so people taking online courses, typically, if you look at the typical MOOC, almost all of the people who are taking MOOCs have done MOOCs before. But we have, we've been sort of pleasantly, at least sort of, well, not surprised, but at least not disappointed as much as we could have, in the sense that we have a higher than average fraction of people doing their first MOOC with us. So we're kind of bringing new users to use online learning opportunities. But we'd like to see more of that. And I think there's like there's a way to go before we're anywhere near sort of solving that problem altogether.
Maybe since you're speaking about the people taking the classes and so on, this brings to my mind the fact that you're sitting in Helsinki and how much the educational system in Finland is, you know, helping, having an environment, because it seems that the system over there is geared towards giving students the tools to be in an uncertain environment rather than transferring knowledge. And this seems to be very important in a society 4.0 or whatever we want to call it. How do you see this heritage from the Finnish system? And because this is something that we can learn in the rest of Europe and the world, you know, it's something that is very interesting for the rest of us.
Yeah, I have to say I'm sort of very, you know, proud to be a Finn when it comes to the education system, and I'm very proud of the system. I've got two kids, and of course I've studied at the, you know, Finnish school system myself, and I'm very happy the way it's been developing in the last year. So sort of based on the solid foundation of highly trained, highly motivated teachers, they've been given a lot of autonomy to design the teaching in their like everyday teaching. I think that's the basis on which these kind of revisions of the curriculum are also built. You basically have to offer new teaching materials, and then the teachers will go and navigate, you know, their way to find them and adapt and adopt them in their teaching. And that's a great asset in a way of the Finnish school system, the teachers, and them being so highly trained so that they can easily sort of adopt new teaching methodologies and new materials. But that said, we've kind of observed that the element of AI seems to work at least all around Europe, very well. We haven't basically changed a single thing in the course, like in translations, now that we've launched it in every EU country with the support of the Finnish government and the European Commission. We've got translations in all EU languages. We've got partners in every EU country. And we're working with them, and we're getting good feedback from the users and our partners. And again, you know, we haven't changed a single thing. So we haven't, you know, found that, okay, in this country, you have to start from here, or you could sort of, you'd have to add some sort of material here and there. It's been the exact same course in every country, and it seems to work. And there's been great uptake in many, many countries. Of course, there's variation, but nonetheless, it's been very positive response. And now it's interesting going beyond Europe. I think in still thinking inside Europe, we're kind of, you know, Europe is not the whole world. And there are places where the education system is even more difficult, more different from the Finnish one than in any European country. And now we're sort of learning our way to other regions as well, and we're doing the first experiments, for instance, with the University of Nairobi in Kenya, and seeing how it works there, first with the university students and then with the general public. And that's a really interesting experiment as well. But yeah, I think the school system, it's helped us, but it doesn't seem to be like that you'd have to change all that much at the end of the day from country to country.
That's very interesting, and it brings me to a more broader reflection. And perhaps I would like to ask Mario to give us a perspective on this. How in the project that you are coordinating, you are considering all these elements related to the educational system. How this conversation we're having about the skills is going to relate with the way work is changing, and what are the areas that you are watching out in the project on this regard?
Thank you, Giuseppe. Thank you both, actually. My conclusion is that you need to have the right mix, right? I mean, if you want to achieve, let's call it a nice symbiosis between technology and humans. From one hand, you need to equip them with the tools to learn how to use that technology, what this technology means for them, make AI boring, as Temu said. I mean, I like it very much. So having these technological tools, but on the other hand, you also have to kind of foster those skills that are properly humans, all these non-cognitive skills, creativity, working in team, you know, taking initiatives and all that stuff, which is somehow, in a way, you could consider it at the opposite, right? I mean, like, it's really, really human, because in that way, you build humans that can really be complemented by technology, not really substituted by technology. So I look at you guys, I mean, like with a bit of envy, because it seems to me that the educational system really is, I mean, is the closest that we have towards that, to give, you know, the tools to kids to, you know, seek their knowledge by themselves in this uncertain environment, which, as Giuseppe said before, where we are going to be more and more. While it seems to me that instead many countries in Europe are still geared towards providing pupils with more knowledge, they're like still locked into this industry 1.0 setting, in which you are building, you know, people that have to be like a more schematic job somehow. So I think everything that I read, everything that we work on, I mean, our research insights, I mean, many, I mean, it's not just us, I mean, is pointed to the fact that we should try to change structurally our educational systems. It's not easy, obviously. We need like more revolution than a slight change, I think. But I think it's useful to start thinking about it and talking about it, because I mean, that's the future. I mean, otherwise, I mean, like, we'll miss a big opportunity. And the fact that, I mean, the Finns are always excelling in all sorts of rankings. It's like telling, of course, is just a ranking. I mean, like, it has its own limitations, but, you know, people are surprised. The kids don't do homeworks. And then, I mean, like, in the continental Europe, let's say the Southern Europe, I come from Italy, I mean, like, we are surprised. I mean, like, we have a lot of homeworks, and still we perform much worse. So, you know, maybe it's something, something to think about, something to, you know, for us to change.
Yeah, no, I have to say that this is outside my area of expertise. As I said, I'm not an educator by training, so I'm sort of stepping outside my expertise here. But my thinking sort of resonates a lot with what you're saying, and I think like we should definitely sort of understand that AI is not going to replace humans, but it's going to give us better tools to do what we're doing. And as I said, like if you're thinking of let's say the work of a teacher, there's going to be some aspects of that are not like very human aspects or humane aspects. They're more like sort of repetitive things. Let's say think of language teaching, you know, you just have to repeat certain things. So I think there's like there's room for AI applications in education as well. But to be honest, I'm quite I was using somewhere the term old school in terms of my approach to teaching applications or education applications of AI. I think the teachers really are the key there. And of course the children, but you know, it's not that that I see a lot of the teachers' work being something that could be automated. It's exactly like what you said, Mario, that learning a lot of sort of non-cognitive skills, the teamwork skills, the ability to construct your own ideas and communicate them to others, critical thinking, you know, and you could sort of, you know, then you get into digital literacy, media literacy, and these kind of things are really at the core, and they're like complementary to a large extent to what can be done by analyzing large amounts of data or by AI or machine learning. And that's why I think that in a way, I kind of see it as a positive opportunity that AI is being used to automate the routine work that we're doing, because it will sort of free up the remaining time, our work time and our effort into the kind of the more human activities that cannot be replaced and automated. And that, in that sense, like I see the future as a more humane sort of future where the kind of the routine and even the dangerous and boring things can be automated by AI, and then more time is sort of freed up for being more creative, you know, interacting with other people and yeah, you being human beings, doing what human beings do the best, not being machines.
That's a very brilliant way for closing our episode, actually, because as you say, in the end of the day, this balance between being human and being the machine, it is in the end one of the key debate that we are going to have, I would say even philosophical debate that goes beyond the project on the future work that we are doing at Bruegel, obviously, but it is going to be a fundamental question in terms of how can we ensure that we stay human, how we can ensure that AI helps us in order to, as you say, ensure that we have more time to be human rather than repetitively repeating tasks which can be given to the machines. So that's very interesting, and definitely we are going to come back to this underlying philosophical point with Mario in some next episodes of The Sound of Economics. So I would like to thank you, Temu, for your time with us.
My pleasure, definitely. Mario, Giuseppe, it was really nice to have a chat with you, and looking forward to hearing your next episodes on those philosophical matters as well.
Thank you, and I want to remind our listeners that this episode is linked to the research project at Bruegel on future work and inclusive growth in Europe, and The Sound of Economics will keep following the project and there will be more episodes dedicated to this theme, as I just said. And as usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website www.bruegel.org. Thanks a lot for joining The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.